The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 2, Section 1, continued. Cassette 4, Side 1. In the very first place, the whole guard system was no good. These weren't real camps at all. They had guards posted on the watchtowers only at night, and at the gatehouse there was just one unarmed guard who could even be persuaded to let one out for a bit. They were still permitting kerosene lighting around the perimeter, and several dozen prisoners were being taken to work outside the camp by just a single rifleman. So now they wired the perimeter for electric light, using politically reliable electricians and motor mechanics. The riflemen of the guard were provided with battle statutes and military training. Attack-trained German shepherds were included in the required service staffs, with their own breeders and trainers and their own separate statutes. The camps began to assume, at long last, a fully modern, contemporary appearance, which we know very well indeed. This is not the place to list the many small details of daily life in which the camp regimen was made stricter and tightened up, and the many cracks that were discovered via which freedom could still observe the archipelago. All those ties were now broken off, and the cracks were filled in, and the last few observers' commissions were expelled. There is not going to be any other place in the book for an explanation of what these were, so let this be a lengthy note for those curious about it. Hypocritical bourgeois society thought up the idea of inspection of conditions in places of confinement and of the course of prisoner correction. In Tsarist Russia, the societies of guardianship over prisons, for the improvement of the physical and moral state of the prisoners, were the charitable prison committees and the societies of prison patronage. In American prisons, commissions of observers, consisting of public representatives, already possessed broad rights in the 20s and 30s, including even the right of release ahead of term, not petitioning for it, but release itself without action by a court. And indeed our dialectical legal experts pointedly protest. One must not forget what classes the commissions represent. They reach decisions in accordance with their class interests. It is quite a different thing here, in our country. The very first temporary instruction of July the 23rd, 1918, which created the first camps, provided for the creation of assignment commissions attached to provincial penal departments. They assigned all sentenced prisoners one of seven different types of confinement, which had been established in the early Russian Soviet Federated Socialist Republic. This work, which apparently replaced that of the courts, was so important that the People's Commissariat of Justice in its report of 1920 called the activity of the assignment commissions the nerve center of penal operations. Their makeup was very democratic. In 1922, for example, it was a troika, the chief of the provincial NKVD administration, a member of the presidium of the provincial court, and the chief of places of confinement in the specific province. Later on, one person was added from the Provincial Workers and Peasants Inspection and the Provincial Trade Union Council. But as early as 1929, there was great dissatisfaction with the commissions. They exercised their power to release prisoners before the end of term and to grant other benefits to hostile class elements. This was the rightist opportunist practice of the NKVD leadership. For this reason, assignment commissions were abolished in that selfsame year of the great turning point, and in their place, observers' commissions were created whose chairmen were judges and whose members consisted of the chief of the camp, the prosecutor, and a representative of the public, from workers in penal institutions, the police, the district executive committee, or the Komsomol. And, as our jurists pointedly declared, one must not forget what classes... Oh, excuse me, I have already quoted that. And the observers' commissions were entrusted with these tasks by the NKVD to decide the question of time-off sentences and release before the end of term, and by VTSIK, so to speak by Parliament, to verify the fulfillment of the production and financial plans. And it was these observers' commissions which were abolished at the beginning of the second five-year plan. Speaking frankly, none of the prisoners sighed over the loss. Another thing about classes, now that we've mentioned them. One of the authors of that same collection we have cited so often before, Shestakova, on the basis of materials from the 20s and the beginnings of the 30s, reached a strange conclusion as to the similarity of the social origins of prisoners in bourgeois prisons and in our country. To her surprise, it turned out that both there and here, those in prison were workers. Well, of course, there has to be some kind of dialectical explanation here, but she couldn't find any. And we will add on our own behalf that this strange resemblance was violated only in a minor degree in 1937 to 1938, when high state officials flocked into the camps. But very soon, the proportions evened out. All the multimillion waves of the war and the post-war period consisted only of waves of the working classes. At the same time, the camp phalanxes, even though there seemed to have been glimmerings of socialism in them, were renamed columns so as to distinguish them from Francos. The camp security section, which up to this time had had to make allowances for the goals of the general productive work and of the plan, now acquired its own self-contained dominating significance, to the detriment of all kinds of productive work and of any staff of specialists. True, they did not drive out the camp cultural and educational sections, but this was partly because it was convenient to collect denunciations and summon stool pigeons through them. And an iron curtain descended around the archipelago. No one, other than the officers and sergeants of the NKVD, could enter and leave via the camp gatehouse. That harmonious order of things was established, which the Zeks themselves would soon come to consider the only conceivable one, the one we will describe in this part of the book. Without the red ribbons by this time, and containing much more labor than correction. And that is when the wolf's fangs were bared, and that is when the bottomless pit of the archipelago gaped wide. I'll shoo you in tin cans, but you're going to go out to work. If there aren't enough railroad ties, I'll make one out of you. And that is when, sending freight trains through Siberia with a machine gun on the roof of every third car, they drove the 58s into excavation pits to guard them more securely. And that was when, even before the first shot of World War II, back when all Europe still danced foxtrots, they could not manage to crush the lice in the Mariinsk distributor, the intercamp transit prison of the Mariinsk camps, and brushed them off the clothes with whisk brooms. Typhus broke out, and in one short period 15,000 corpses were thrown into a ditch, curled up and naked, since even their underpants had been cut off them to be preserved for future use. We have already recalled the typhus which raged at the Vladivostok transit camp. And there was only one of its new acquisitions of the recent past that Gulag did not part with, the encouragement of the hoodlums, the thieves, the blatnye. Even more consistently than before, the thieves were given all the commanding heights in camp. Even more consistently than before, the thieves were egged on against the 58s, permitted to plunder them without any obstacles, to beat, to choke. The thieves became just like an internal camp police, camp storm troopers. During the war years, in many camps, the custodial staffs were cut back to almost nothing, and their work was entrusted to the commandant's headquarters, meaning to the thieves who had become bitches, to the bitches, and the bitches were more effective than any custodial staff. After all, there was no prohibition against their beating. They say that in February to March 1938, a secret instruction was circulated in the NKVD, reduce the number of prisoners, and not by releasing them, of course. I do not see anything in the least impossible here. This was a logical instruction, because there was simply not enough housing, clothing, or food. Gulag was grinding to a halt from exhaustion. And this was when the pellagra victims lay down and died en masse. This was when the chiefs of convoy began to test the accuracy of machine gun fire by shooting at the stumbling Zeks. And this was when every morning the orderlies hauled the corpses to the gatehouse, stacking them there. In the Kolyma, that pole of cold and cruelty in the archipelago, that very same about-face took place with a sharpness worthy of a pole. According to the recollections of Ivan Semyonovich Karpunich-Braben, former commander of the 40th Division and of the 12th Corps, who recently died with his notes incomplete and scattered, a most dreadfully cruel system of food, work, and punishment was established in the Kolyma. The prisoners were so famished that at Zaroshi Spring they ate the corpse of a horse, which had been lying dead for more than a week, and which not only stank but was covered with flies and maggots. At Utini Goldfield, the Zeks ate half a barrel of lubricating grease brought there to grease the wheelbarrows. At Malga they ate Iceland moss like the deer. And when the passes were shut by snowdrifts, they used to issue 3.5 ounces of bread a day at the distant goldfields, without ever making up for previous deficiencies. Multitudes of goners, unable to walk by themselves, were dragged to work on sledges by other goners who had not yet become quite so weak. Those who lagged behind were beaten with clubs and torn by dogs. Working in 50 degrees below zero Fahrenheit, they were forbidden to build fires and warm themselves. The thieves were allowed this. Karpunich himself also tried cold drilling by hand with a steel drill 6.5 feet long, and hauling so-called peat, soil with broken stone and boulders, at 60 degrees below zero on sledges to which 4 men were hitched. The sledges were made of raw lumber, and the boxes on top were made of raw slab. A fifth accompanied them, a thief expediter, responsible for fulfillment of the plan, who kept beating them with a stave. Those who did not fulfill the norm, and what does it mean, those who did not fulfill, because after all the production of the 58th was always stolen by the thieves, were punished by the chief of the camp, Zeldin, in this way. In winter, he ordered them to strip naked in the mine shaft, poured cold water over them, and in this state they had to run to the compound. In summer, they were forced to strip naked, their hands were tied behind them to a common pole, and they were left out, tied there, under a cloud of mosquitoes. The guard was covered by a mosquito net. Then, finally, they were simply beaten with a rifle butt and tossed into an isolator. Some will object that there was nothing new in all this and no development, that this was a mere primitive return from the noisily educational canals to the directness of Solovki. Bah! But perhaps this was a Hegelian triad. Solovki, Belomor, Kolyma. Thesis, antithesis, synthesis. The negation of a negation, but enriched. For example, here are the death carriages, which, so far as can be learned, did not exist on Solovki. This is according to the recollections of Karpunich at Marizny Spring, 41 miles along the Srednekhen Trail. For an entire 10-day period, the chief tolerated non-fulfillment of the norm. Only on the 10th day did he imprison in the isolator on a penalty ration those who had failed to fulfill, and then had them taken out to work again. But whoever did not fulfill the norm, even in these circumstances, was given the carriage, a frame of 16 by 10 by 6 feet on a tractor sledge, made of rough beams, fastened together with construction staples. A small door, no windows, and inside nothing at all, not even any bedboards. In the evening, those to be punished, sunk into a torpor, and already indifferent, were taken from the penalty isolator and packed into the carriage, locked in there with an enormous lock, and hauled off by tractor to a vale 2 to 3 miles from the camp. Several of those inside cried out, but the tractor unhitched them and left them there for a day. After a day, it was unlocked, and the corpses were tossed out. The winter storms would bury them. At Malga, a subordinate camp of Elgin, under Chief Gavrik, the punishments for women who failed to fulfill the norm were lighter, simply an unheated tent in winter, but one was allowed to go outside and run around it. and at haying time under the mosquitoes, an unprotected wattle shack. The Recollections of Sliotsberg. The intensification of the cruelty of the Kolyma regime was outwardly marked by the fact that Garanin was made the chief of U.S. Vietlag, the administration of northeastern camps, and that the divisional commander of the Latvian riflemen, E. Bertzin, was replaced as head of Dalstroy by Pavlov. Incidentally, this totally unnecessary reshuffle was due to Stalin's suspiciousness. What was there to make one think that the old Czechist Bertzin could not just as well have satisfied the new demands of his associate? Would he have hesitated? At that point, they abolished the remaining days off for the 58th and lengthened the summer work day to 14 hours, came to consider 50 and 60 degrees below zero Fahrenheit suitable for work, and allowed work to be cancelled only on those days when the temperature was lower than 65 degrees below zero Fahrenheit. And because of the caprices of individual chiefs, some took the prisoners out for work even at 75 below. At the Gorny Goldfields, plagiarizing Solovki once more, those who refused to go out to work were tied to the sledges and hauled thus to the mine face. It was also accepted in the Kolyma that the convoy was not only present to guard the prisoners, but was also answerable for their fulfillment of the plan, and therefore had to avoid dozing and continue slave-driving them eternally. And then, too, the scurvy finished off many without any help from the administration. But all that was too little, insufficiently strict, and the number of prisoners wasn't being sufficiently reduced. And so, the Garanin shootings began, which were outright murders, sometimes to the roar of tractors, sometimes without. Many camp points were known for executions and mass graves, Orotukan and Polyarny Spring, and Svistopolyas, and Anushka, and even the agricultural camp Dukcha. But the most famous of all on this account were the Zolotisti Goldfields, chief of camp Petrov, security operations officers Zelenkov and Anisimov, chief of the goldfield Barkalov, chief of the district branch of the NKVD Burov, and the Serpantinka. At Zolotisti, they used to summon a brigade from the mine face in broad daylight and shoot the members down one after another. And this was not a substitute for night executions. They took place too. When the chief of Yuglag, Nikolai Andreevich Aglanov, arrived, he liked at line-up to pick out some brigade or other which had been a fault for something or other, and order it to be taken aside. And then he used to empty his pistol into the frightened, crowded mass of people, accompanying his shots with happy shouts. The corpses were left unburied. In May they used to decompose, and at that point the goners, who had survived until then, were summoned to cover them up, in return for a beefed-up ration, even including spirits. At the Serpantinka they used to shoot from 30 to 50 men every day, under an overhanging roof near the isolator. Then they dragged the corpses off behind a hillock on tractor sledges. The tractor drivers, the stevedores, and the grave diggers lived in a separate barracks. After Garanin himself had been shot, they shot all of them, too. And another technique was used there. They led them up to a deep shaft blindfolded and shot them in the ear or the back of the head. No one mentions any resistance whatsoever. They shut down the Serpantinka and leveled both the isolator there and everything connected with the shootings and filled in those shafts as well. In 1954, they discovered commercial gold ores at the Serpentinka about which they had not known earlier, and they had to mine among human bones. The gold was more precious. At those same gold fields where no executions were conducted, notices were read aloud or posted with the names in big letters and the alleged causes in small letters. For counter-revolutionary propaganda, for insulting the convoy, for failure to fulfill the norm. The executions were stopped temporarily because the plan for getting out the gold was not being fulfilled, and because they could not send new groups of prisoners across the frozen Okhotsk Sea. M.I. Kononenko waited more than half a year to be shot at the Surfing Tinker and survived. In addition, the regime hardened in respect to tacking on new terms. Gavrik at Malga used to organize this in a picturesque way. They used to ride ahead on horseback with torches in the Arctic night, and behind them they pulled with ropes to the district NKVD, 18 miles, those who faced new charges. At other camps it was all very routine. The classification and record sections merely selected from the card file those whose unreasonably short terms were coming to an end, summoned them in groups of 80 to 100 people, and prescribed for each a new tenor, R.V. Retz. Actually, I almost left Kolyma out of this book. Kolyma was a whole separate continent of the archipelago, and it deserves its own separate histories. Yes, and Kolyma was fortunate. Varlam Shalamov survived there, and has already written a lot. Yevgenia Ginsberg survived there, and O. Tsliotsberg, N. Surovtseva, N. Grankina, and others. And all of them have written memoirs. How is it that there is such a concentration of Kolyma memoirs, while the non-Kolyma memoirs are almost non-existent? Was this because they really hauled off the cream of the crop to Kolyma? Or was it, no matter how strange this may seem, that in the nearby camps they died off more rapidly? I only permit myself to cite here several lines of V. Shalamov on the Garanin executions. For many months there, day and night, at the morning and the evening checks, innumerable execution orders were read out. In a temperature of 50 below zero, the musicians from among the non-political offenders played a flourish before and after each order was read. The smoking gasoline torches ripped apart the darkness. The thin sheet on which the order was written was covered with hoarfrost, and some chief or other who was reading the order would brush the snowflakes from it with his sleeve so as to decipher and shout out the name of the next man on the list of those shot. And so it was that the archipelago completed the second five-year plan and, it would seem, entered socialism. The beginning of the war shook the archipelago chieftains. The course of the war at the very start was such that it might very likely have led to the breakdown of the entire archipelago, and perhaps even to the employers having to answer to the workers. As far as one can judge from the impressions of the Zeks from various camps, the course of events gave rise to two different kinds of conduct among the bosses. Some of them, those who were either more reasonable or perhaps more cowardly, relaxed their regime and began to talk with the prisoners almost gently, particularly during the weeks of military defeats. They were unable, of course, to improve the food or the maintenance. Others, who were more stubborn and more vicious, began, on the contrary, to be even stricter and more threatening with the 58s, as if to promise them death before liberation. In the majority of the camps, they did not even announce the beginning of the war to the prisoners. Our implacable passion for lies and secrecy. And only on Monday did the Zeks learn of it from those unescorted by convoy and from free personnel. Wherever radio existed, such as at Ust-Vim and many places in the Kolyma, it was silenced for the whole period of our military failures. In that very same Ust-Vim camp, they suddenly forbade the prisoners to write letters home. They could still receive them. And their kinfolk thereupon decided they had all been shot. And in some camps, sensing intuitively the direction of future policy, they began to isolate the 58s from the non-political offenders in compounds guarded with particular strictness, put machine guns up on the watchtowers, and even spoke thus to the Zeks who had formed up. You are hostages! Oh, how effervescent is this charge of carbonation right from the Civil War! How hard it is to forget those words, and how easily they are remembered. If Stalingrad falls, we are going to shoot the lot of you. And that was the atmosphere in which the archipelago natives asked about war communiques. Is Stalingrad still holding out, or has it already fallen? And in the Kolyma, they hauled the Germans, Poles, and particularly notable prisoners from the 58s, two such special compounds. But they immediately began to free the Poles in August 1941. 186 Poles were released from Zolotysti out of 2,100 brought there a year before. They went into Sikorsky's army in the west, and there, evidently, they told all about Zolotysti. And in June 1942, it was completely shut down. From the first days of the war, everywhere in the archipelago, on opening the packages of mobilization instructions, they halted all releases of 58s. There were even cases of released prisoners being sent back to camp while on their way home. In Uchta, on June the 23rd, a group released was already outside the perimeter waiting for a train when the convoy chased them back and even cursed them. "It's because of you the war began." Karpunich received his release papers on the morning of June the 23rd, but had not yet succeeded in getting through the gatehouse when they coaxed them out of him by fraud. "Show them to us." He showed them and was kept in camp for another 5 years. This was considered to mean until special orders. When the war had already come to an end, in many camps they were forbidden even to go to the classification and records section and ask when they would be freed. The point was that after the war there were not enough people for a while, and many local administrations, even if Moscow allowed them to release prisoners, issued their own special orders so as to hold on to manpower. And that was how Y.M. Orlova was held in Karlag, and why she did not manage to get home in time to see her dying mother. From the very beginning of the war, in accordance, no doubt, with those same mobilization instructions, food norms were lowered in all camps, and the foodstuffs all got worse from year to year. Vegetables were replaced by fodder turnips, grits by vetch and bran. The Kolyma was supplied from America, and in some places there, in contrast, even white bread put in an appearance. But as a result of the prisoners growing weaker, the fall-off in output in vital lines of production became so bad, from 80 to 90%, that they found it useful to return to pre-war norms. Many camp production centers got orders for munitions, and the enterprising directors of such mini-factories sometimes managed to feed the Zeks with supplementary food from auxiliary gardens. Wherever they paid wages, these amounted in cash to 30 rubles monthly, and in terms of wartime prices on the open market, to less than 1 kilogram of potatoes a month. If one were to ask a wartime camp inmate his highest, supreme, and totally unattainable ambition, he would reply, "To eat just once a bellyful of black bread, and then I could die." During the war, they buried no fewer dead in the camps than at the front, except that they have not been eulogized by the poets. L.A. Komogor, in a team of enfeebled prisoners, was engaged in the following light work for the entire winter of 1941 to 1942. Packing coffin crates made of 4 boards, 2 naked corpses to each, head by feet, at the rate of 30 boxes a day. Evidently the camp was close to the capital, which is why the corpses had to be packed into crates. The first month of the war passed, and the country adapted to the wartime rhythm of life. Those who had to went off to the front, and those who had to went off to the rear, and those who had to engaged in leadership and wiped their brows after drinking. And so it was in the camps, too. It turned out that all the scare had been for nothing, that everything was standing firm, that just as this particular spring had been wound up in 1937, so it would keep on working without stopping. Those jailers who at first had tried to curry favor among the Zeks now became fierce and knew no moderation or let-up. It turned out that the forms, the system of camp life, had been determined correctly once and for all, and would continue so for all eternity. 7 camp epochs will lay their cases before you, arguing as to which was worst for the human being. But pay attention to that of wartime. Zeks put it this way: whoever didn't serve time in wartime didn't know what camp was really like. Throughout the winter of 1941 to 1942 at Vyatlag, only in the barracks of the engineering and technical personnel and in the repair shops was any warmth of life flickering at all. And all the rest was frozen cemeteries. And Biatlag was actually engaged in cutting firewood for the Perm Railroad. Here's what the wartime camp was. More work and less food and less heat and worse clothes and ferocious discipline and more severe punishment. And that still wasn't all. The Zecs had always been deprived of external, audible protest, but the war even did away with the protest inside the soul. Any scoundrel with shoulder boards who was hiding from the front could shake his finger and preach, "And how are people dying at the front? And how are they working in freedom? And how many have died in Leningrad?" And as a result, the Zecs had no protest left even inside themselves. Yes, people were dying at the front, some of them lying in the snow, too. Yes, they were squeezing the life out of people in freedom, and the people were famished and starving. Yes, and the Free Labor Front, into which unmarried girls from the villages were mobilized, and in which they worked at logging, had only 24.5 ounces of bread and soup, which was dishwater and was as bad as any camp. Yes, and in the Leningrad blockade they allotted even less than the camp punishment cell ration. During the war, the whole cancerous tumor of the archipelago turned out to be, or in any case represented itself to be, an allegedly important and necessary organ of the Russian body. It, too, was allegedly working for the war. On it, too, victory depended. And all this shed a false and justifying light on the strands of barbed wire, on the citizen chief who was shaking his finger. And there you were dying as one of the tumor's rotting cells, and you were deprived even of the dying man's satisfaction of cursing it. For the 58s, the wartime camps were particularly unbearable because of their pasting on second terms, which hung over the prisoners' heads worse than any axe. The security officers, busily engaged in saving themselves from the front, discovered in well-set-up backwaters and backwoods, in logging expeditions, plots involving the participation of the world bourgeoisie, plans for armed revolts and mass escapes. Such aces of gulag as Y.M. Morotz, the chief of Uchtpechlag, particularly encouraged investigatory and interrogatory activity in his camps. In Uchtpechlag, sentences poured as if from a sack. Execution, 20 years, for incitement to escape, for sabotage. And how many there were for whom no trials at all were required, whose fates were determined by the movement of the stars. Sikorsky displeased Stalin, and in one night they seized 30 Polish women at Elgin and took them off and shot them. There were many Zeks, and this is something which was not fabricated, it is quite true, who applied from the first days of the war to be sent to the front. They had tasted the most foully stinking camp dregs, and now they asked to be sent to the front in order to defend this camp system and to die for it in a penalty company. "And if I come out of it alive, I will return to serve out the rest of my term." The Orthodox communists now assure us that they were the ones who begged to be sent to the front. And some of them did, including those Trotskyites who had survived the executions, but not very many. For the most part, they had got themselves set up in certain quiet spots in camp, not without the help of the communist chiefs either, where they could spend their time in contemplation, discussion, recollection, and waiting. And after all, in a penalty company, you'd last no more than 3 days. This desire to enlist was an impulse not of ideological principle, but of heart. This is what the Russian character was. It is better to die in an open field than in a rotten shed. To unwind, to become, even for just a short while, like everyone else, an unrepressed citizen. To get away from the stagnant feeling of doom here, from the pasting on of new terms, from silent annihilation. And some of them took an even simpler view of it all, but one which was not in the least shameful. Out there you would still die eventually, but for the moment they would give you a uniform to wear, feed you up, give you something to drink, transport you, and you could look out of the window of the railroad car and you could flirt with the girls at the stations. And then, too, there was an attitude of good-natured forgiveness. You've wronged us, and here's how we answer you. However, for the state, there was no economic nor organizational sense in carrying out all this superfluous shifting about of some people from camp to the front, and some people to camp in their place. Everyone had had his own circle of life and death determined for him. Once you've been classified among the goats, then you have to die as a goat. Sometimes they did take non-political offenders with short terms for the front, and not in penalty companies, of course, just in the ordinary active army. It didn't happen at all often, but there were cases in which they took 58s as well. Vladimir Sergeyevich Gorshunov was taken from camp to the front in 1943, and at the end of the war, he was returned to camp with an extended sentence. They were all marked men, and it was simple for the security chief in their unit to paste a new term on them, much simpler than on newcomers. But the camp authorities did not entirely disregard this wave of patriotism. At the logging operations, it had little impact. But slogans like, "Let's give coal above plan, it's light for Leningrad," or "Let us support the guard units with mortar ammunition," caught on well, as eyewitnesses report. Arseny Farmakov, a venerable person with a well-adjusted personality, tells how their camp was caught up in work for the front. He intended to describe it. The Zeks were unhappy when they were refused permission to collect money for a tank column, the Jidzinets. This phenomenon requires elucidation on many different planes, as in fact does the entire Soviet-German war. The decades go by. We do not manage to sort things out and understand ourselves, even on one plane, before the next one is deposited in a new layer of ash. There have not been freedom and purity of information in any decade, and from one blow to the next, people have not been able to comprehend either themselves or others or events. And as to rewards for this, as is universally known, soon after the end of the war, an amnesty was proclaimed for deserters, swindlers, and thieves, and special camps for the 58s. And the closer the war came to its end, the more and more cruel did the regimen for the 58s become. Nor did one have to go far away from Moscow to the Jidda or the Kolyma camps to find this out. Right outside Moscow itself, almost within the boundaries of the city, in Kovrino, there was a shabby little factory to supply the internal needs of the NKVD itself. And attached to it, a strict regimen camp run by Mamulov, who was all-powerful because his own brother was the chief of Beria's secretariat. This Mamulov would pick out anyone he wanted from the Krasnaya Presnia transit prison, and he set up whatever regimen he pleased in his camplet. For example, he allowed visits with relatives, which were widely permitted almost everywhere in camps near Moscow, to be conducted only through two screens, as in prison. And he had the same kind of prison system in his barracks, many bright lights left on at night, constant observation of those who were sleeping to make sure that on cold nights they would not cover themselves with their padded jackets. If they did, they were awakened. In the punishment cells, he had a clean cement floor and nothing else at all, just as in a regular, efficient prison. But no punishment he had designated gave him any satisfaction unless along with it and before it he bloodied the nose of the culprit. In addition, late-night inspections by the male jailers of the women's barracks, holding up to 450 prisoners, were a regular practice in his camp. They rushed in with wild whoops and the command, "Stand next to your cots!" The half-dressed women jumped up, and the jailers searched both their persons and their beds with the minute thoroughness required to find a needle or a love note. If anything was discovered, the prisoner was sentenced to the punishment cell. Shklinik, chief of the chief mechanics section, went about the different factory sections on the night shift like a stooping gorilla, and no sooner had he noticed that someone had begun to doze, to nod his head, or shut his eyes, than with all his might he would hurl at him an iron block, a pair of pliers, a chunk of steel. Such was the regimen the camp inmates of Kovrino earned with their work for the front. They produced mortar shells throughout the war. The little factory was adapted for this output by a prison engineer. Alas, his name has not been remembered, but it won't get lost for good, of course. He created a design bureau also. He was serving time as a 58 and belonged to that category of human beings most repulsive to Mamulov because they refused to give up their own opinions and convictions. And yet, for a time, Mamulov had to tolerate this good-for-nothing. But no one is irreplaceable in our country. And when production was already sufficiently underway, one day in broad daylight, in the presence of the office personnel, intentionally in their presence, let everyone know, let them tell everyone, and we are telling it too, you see. Mamulov and two of his assistants rushed in, grabbed the engineer by his beard, threw him to the floor, kicked him with their jackboots till the blood flowed, and then sent him off to the Butyrki to get a second term for his political declarations. And this lovely little camplet was just 15 minutes by electric train from the Leningrad station. Not far, just sad. The newcomer Zex, who got into the camps near Moscow, tried to hold on to them tightly if they had relatives in Moscow. Yes, and even without that. It seemed all the same that you were not being torn away into that far distant abyss from which there was no return. That here, despite everything, you were on the edge of civilization. But this was self-deceit. They usually fed the prisoners there worse, calculating that the majority were receiving parcels, and they didn't even issue bedding. But the worst thing was the eternally nauseating latrine rumors which kept hovering over these camps about prisoner transports to far away. Life was as chancy as on the point of a needle, and it was impossible to be certain even for a day that you would be able to live it out in one and the same place. Such are the forms into which the islands of the archipelago hardened. But one need not think that as it hardened, it ceased to exude more metastases from itself. In 1939, before the Finnish War, Gulag's alma mater, Solovki, which had come too close to the west, was moved via the northern sea route to the mouth of the Yenisei River, and there merged into the already created Norilag, which soon reached 75,000 in size. So malignant was Solovki that even in dying it threw off one last metastasis, and what a metastasis! The archipelago's conquest of the unpeopled deserts of Kazakhstan belongs to the pre-war years. That was where the nest of Karaganda camps swelled like an octopus, and fertile metastases were propagated in Dzhezkazgan with its poisoned cuprous water, in Mointi and in Balkhash. And camps spread out over the north of Kazakhstan also. New growth swelled in Novosibirsk province, the Mariinsk camps, in the Krasnoyarsk region, the Kansk camps and Kraslag, in Kakassia, in Buryat Mongolia, in Uzbekistan, even in Gornaya Shoria. Nor did the Russian north, so beloved by the archipelago, end its own growth. Ust-Vimlag, Niroblag, Usolag, nor the Urals, Ivdelag. There are many omissions in this list. It was enough to write Usolag to remember that there was also a camp in Usolye, in Irkutsk province. Yes, there was simply no province, be it Chelyabinsk or Kibyshev, which did not give birth to its own camp. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.